This meeting to order, Committee on Health and Social Services. It is Tuesday, February 9th. It is 3:09 p.m. Let the reflect that there is a quorum and present joining us today, Representative Cisna, Representative Lynn, Representative T. Wilson, Co-Chair Keller, and myself, Bob Heron. Today is teleconference and testimony is scheduled. If you're going to testify, please state your name, your title, your affiliation, and the place of residence for the record. And if you have written testimony, if you could provide that to the secretary, and we'll ensure it is into the record and for distribution. And if you have not, please sign at the witness registrar. If you have a cell phone, please turn it off or silent it. Today, there's three issues that we'll be discussing. We'll have a presentation by the MATSU Substance Abuse Coalition, followed by House Joint Resolution 35, proposing amendments to the Constitution of the State of Alaska, prohibiting the passage of laws that interfere with direct payments for health care services and the right to purchase health care insurance from a privately owned company, and that compel a person to participate in a health care system. The third item that we will address is a bill introduced by former Representative John Coghill, now Senator Coghill, House Bill 168, an act relating to state certification and designation of trauma centers, creating the uncompensated trauma care fund to offset uncompensated trauma care provided at certified and designated trauma centers, and providing for an effective date, also known as the Health Care Freedom Act. So at this time, I would ask my co-chair, Representative Keller, to introduce our first group, please, sir.
Thank you for the privilege of doing that. I'm very proud. When you say the MATSU Substance Abuse Coalition, you're talking some very energetic leaders, and I'm proud because there's been a lot done that you've accomplished, which you'll be explaining to us, I'm sure. When Elizabeth first talked to me about the program, I was enthused, and I want to point out that they have not been down here asking for GF money. That's really cool. I don't know what, if they're going to break that record today or not, but I will give it back to the chair here, but I think he'll want you to come up and introduce yourself as we go here individually and proceed. So thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Keller. Please, for those that are going to give the presentation, please step forward at this time. And we've also been joined by Representative Holmes. Welcome. Okay. If you could, please state your name and affiliation for the record and your hometown.
Elizabeth Ripley, Executive Director of the MATSU Health Foundation and Chair of the MATSU Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition, Wasilla, Alaska.
Good afternoon. Stephanie Allen. I'm the Executive Director for the United Way of MATSU, and I reside in Palmer, Alaska.
Thank you. Of course, you have a presentation that you'll give us. Do you wish to have questions held to the end, or how do you want to do this during the presentation?
We're flexible.
Okay. Please, when the appropriate time, we could probably interject and for questions. So please go ahead. The floor is yours.
Representative Heron, Representative Keller, and fellow HESS committee members, we thank you for this invitation to speak to you today. We're really grateful for this opportunity to tell you about our coalition work. Substance abuse has impacted my family and caused a great deal of heartache and sorrow, and it impacts every sector of our community and our economy. It impacts businesses, the school district, law enforcement, corrections, the healthcare system. You know, and whether you look purely at the economics and productivity, the workforce productivity part of this issue, or you look at the emotional toll on families and individuals, the cost of this issue to our great state and to families and individuals is staggering. So each coalition member that we have quite a variety of stakeholders, from faith-based to law enforcement to healthcare providers to our behavioral health and school district officials, We all have different reasons for being at the table, and so I was going to just let each coalition member very briefly introduce themselves and tell you why they're here. Is that?
Please, if they could get close to a microphone and then put their name and affiliation on the record, that'd be great.
Okay. I'll go ahead and do that.
I got a comment, Mr. Chair, while she's coming here, that I told them that we'd go easy on them. You know, they're a little bit.
What the co-chair meant is that the other committee members will go easy. He will have the hard questions.
Perfect. My name is Nicole Jeffries. I'm a student at Wausau High School. I live in Wausau, Alaska. I'm in this MATSU Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition because I've seen what the effects are and what they can have to my family and my community, and I want to help prevent that.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Robin Hillman. I'm a student at Wausau High School, and I live in Wausau, Alaska. I'm part of the coalition because I had no father around due to substance abuse, drugs, and alcohol, so I'd like to break the cycle.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm Jessica Tremaine. I attend Valley Pathways, and I live in Sutton, Alaska. I'm here because substance abuse has greatly impacted my life, of my family, and also the death of two of my friends.
Thank you for coming.
Hi, I'm Hannah Smith. I attend Wausau High School, but I live in Palmer. I'm here because I have a 23-year-old brother who's an alcoholic, and I don't want that to happen to myself, my younger sister, or any other people in my family or my friends.
Thank you, Hannah.
I'm Patrick Gonzer. I'm a student athlete at Wausau High School, and I'm sick and tired of seeing my friends and student fellow athletes lose eligibility due to substance abuse.
Thank you, Patrick.
I'm Desiree Compton. I'm here with United Way, and I graduated Rochelle High. I've lived in the Valley for 20 years, and a huge proportion of the people I grew up with are dead in jail or have lost custody of their kids because of substance abuse.
So how long have you been out of high school?
Long enough.
Mr. Chairman, you know better than to ask that question.
Yeah, me too.
I thought you were a student.
Gretchen Geist, Executive Director of Community Sports. Having grown up in the Valley, I have had my life, my family's lives, and the lives of several of those who I work with directly affected negatively by substance abuse.
Thank you for coming.
My name is Deb Haynes. I'm a teacher at Wausau High School, and I'm here because I think the most important decision kids are making this day is the choice about drugs or alcohol. So I'm hoping to impact that in a significant, positive way. Thank you.
Deb, thank you for your service. Please go ahead.
I just want to commend the youth that are participating in this presentation today. Part of breaking the cycle of substance abuse is engaging our youth in opportunities for leadership and to learn more and to be able to mentor to their fellow students. And the presentation that we're making to you today, they make to school district, to students in different schools all over the Valley, and I commend them. This is our mission statement. I just take a moment to read that. And the focus of this is really youth, and the location of that focus is our local community, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about in the future. These are just the pieces of what we're going to cover today as we move through. This started in about 2003, 2004. I was on the board of United Way of MATSU at the time, and United Way of America tasked all United Ways across the country with becoming what they called community impact organizations. And so the United Way blueprint was sort of giving the good housekeeping seal of approval to nonprofits and raising funds. And they wanted the United Ways to use a different model of engagement, which is look at what hurts your community, or what changes could you make at your local level that you could measure progress in to affect change in quality of life? And so our board got together and said, where could we make a measurable difference in MATSU? And I want to preface this with, I've served on boards of directors in the past that were health-related boards, where we talked about the issue of substance abuse, where board members said to me, you know, it's just too big. Why should we try? There's no way we're going to make a difference. And the United Way board said, you know, if not us, who? We have to step up. We have to at least chip away at this issue. And I'm really, very pleased that they have the courage to do this. But they're doing it specifically because the fact that it does affect every sector. It affects every member agency of United Way, and it affects all the sectors that I mentioned previously. So the first thing we did was we met with our local behavioral health providers, Nugent's Rants, Alaska Family Services, Mat-Su Health Services, all the different behavioral health providers that we had in the Valley. And we said, what do you think of this idea? And they, you know what they said? They said, you know, we've been thinking about this very seriously for some time, and we've decided that the federal government can't solve our problem, and the state can't solve our problem, that we actually have to address this problem at the community level to have some impact. And so we were thrilled because we were all on the same page. And so the first thing we did was we held a substance abuse summit. We held that in December of 2006. We had about 100 people, stakeholder groups, again, from the faith base to behavioral health and other health care providers to law enforcement, Alaska Mental Health Trust. I mean, everybody was in the room. And we picked four goals at that summit. The first goal was to form a coalition. And just really briefly, we find that coalition work is incredibly effective at addressing health issues. And tobacco is our model, because 50 years ago, over half of Americans smoked. And we have reduced that. It's taken 50 years. Coalition work is slow and methodical, but because it engages all the different stakeholders, it's very, very effective. We've reduced that smoking rate to between 15 and 25%, depending on where you live. That's absolutely phenomenal. So we've cut it in half. So tobacco really is our model for coalition work. And so we chose to approach this issue from the coalition standpoint. And then we had three other goals. The first was to be data-driven. We want to make measurable progress on this issue. We want to be able to demonstrate where we're effective and where we're not effective. And what you're going to hear today, you're going to hear about the data aspect of our project, because that's where we had to start. Well, where are we? The second piece, which is the hardest goal, is that we wanted a coordinated community response. The interesting thing about every time I do this presentation, even when we did it for our local delegation, people stand up in the room who I've never met before in our community, which is a pretty small community, I know a lot of people, and they have a program they're working on that addresses substance abuse. And every time we give this presentation, someone stands up and says, oh, will you endorse our program? And we're actually not about programs, we're about environmental strategies, and you'll hear more about that. But what it reminds me of is that there's a lot of people that care very deeply about this issue. There's a lot of different groups that are working on it, but we're not coordinated. And if we can better communicate and coordinate and make sure all the wheels on that bus are turning in the right direction, we'll probably have a more measurable and meaningful impact than if we're just very disparate in our attempts. And that's definitely the hardest part of what we're trying to do, is get all the stakeholders at the table and strategically move forward, again, following the data. The third piece was to be a leader at the state level and to really help provide some leadership in this area for the state being other coalitions. So up to this point, we've held forums where we've interacted with other coalitions around the state. We brought in Community Anti-Drug Coalitions of America, who by their charter were supposed to go to every state and provide this training. I'd never been to Alaska. So we had coalitions from all over the state attend a training at the Egan Center. So we take that leadership piece, I think, pretty seriously.
Representative Seaton has joined us. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
So the first thing we did, really in preparation for the summit, was to say, it was the experience of our local providers when they came down to Juneau and when they talked to our local delegation, that the questions they got were, well, that's great, I understand about Alaska, but tell me what's happening in Mat-Su. And so we really took a hard look at the data. What do we have to describe the substance abuse problem in Mat-Su? Well, there wasn't a whole lot there, to be quite honest. And so we commissioned a study, a five-year retrospective study of the available data. We worked with local providers to see what data they are collecting and what would be meaningful to collect in the future. And then we took a look at the youth risk behavior survey data. Now, this was 2005, 2006, so we were actually 2006 and preparing for the summit. What we found was the YRBS data for MATSU was not released to MATSU on the regional level for 2005 because the sample size was insufficient. And so one of the things that our coalition supports is Senate Bill 101 because this legislation will allow parents to opt out of instead of having to opt in for survey participation, and that's why our sample size were so low. So this data, this youth piece, was so critical to be able to, one, benchmark where we were, and two, measure our progress, that we decided to actually commission our own survey and worked very closely with the school district. And we commissioned the Alaska Healthy Kids Survey, and we had it tested for being culturally appropriate and all the other different ways to make sure it was a valid and reliable survey tool. We didn't use, as Representative Keller said, any federal or state funds to conduct this survey. It was financed by the MATSU Health Foundation. And Stephanie Allen, Executive Director of United Way, is going to speak more specifically about the survey at this point.
All right, as you can see, the survey was broken up into different components. There's basic demographic information that was provided back to our coalition, specific information about alcohol, tobacco, and other drug use, which is often referred to as ATOD. And in that section, you'll see information, we'll cover it a little bit later in the presentation, that you'll see alcohol and tobacco, marijuana, heroin, meth, inhalants, other drugs such as those. Then there was also a correlate section that was included in this survey. And this section examined behaviors and attitudes associated with substance use. Things such as the age of first use, access to substances, the messages and communication to students. There was also a section in this survey that was beneficial to the school district, which included violence, harassment, safety, and crime information that was given to the students to fill out. And then an external assets piece. That component examined the presence of resilience factors, protective factors, and positive assets in youth that are associated with a decrease in risky behaviors. Things such as high expectations from adults, caring adults, and feeling connected to their school. And then the last section that you can see is about emotional and physical health. And this survey was administered to all 7th, 9th, and 11th graders throughout the school district, to homeschools, Christian schools, and also to homeless and at-risk youth in our community. The survey was sent out to 4,000 youth, and we did have, as you can see, 2,524 surveys received, and of those, 2,435 were valid, which is a 61% response rate, which we are really excited about. You can see just a small breakdown there as well, how many from high school, how many from middle school, and the breakdown between male and female.
So, excuse me, if I could ask a question. It was brought up, what's the difference between SB 101 and this survey?
The YRBS looks at health behaviors, exercise behaviors. It does include some substance use questions. It includes some sexual activity questions. It's a very broad survey instrument. This does look particularly with a substance use and those correlates and assets associated with youth using, really. We did add the section too for the schools, looking at the safety and harassment issues and any kind of violence issues that may be prevalent in the school system as well.
Thank you.
This is just an overall breakdown of the demographics of the students that participated in the survey, 7th, 9th, and 11th graders. And then we did.
Yes, could a Representative Seaton have a question?
And are those demographics basically the demographics of the MATSU, or are they skewed in some way by response?
What we see as at a community level is somewhere, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere around 82-83% Caucasian, and about 12% of Alaska Native American Indian. So this does show slightly less Caucasian than our overall community level population information that we have.
But this does accurately represent the demographics of our youth in the community, because roughly half of our half of the family or households in Mat-Su have children. And so the whole demographic, so the families that have children, that does racially correlate and ethnically correlate.
Thank you, Ms. Chairman.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Okay. So after the report was given back to the coalition, what the coalition did was take all that information and go back to those same sector groups that we've mentioned already, healthcare, law enforcement, the school district, different behavioral health providers, faith-based groups. And so what we did is we went around and basically held focus groups, giving them the information from the data report and allowing them to review it and then get their feedback, which helped to guide our overall strategic plan and to help us basically narrow down our priorities. At this time, we would like to bring up some of our dedicated youth leaders that you met just a few minutes ago. Nicole will start. She'll continue our presentation by reviewing some of the data and highlighting the first of the coalition's recommendations.
Stephanie, I guess what I'll ask for the others that have come up is maybe they'll already do this, but in the survey, could they share what surprised them and what did not surprise them?
Okay.
Thank you. Just for the record, please state your name again, please.
I'm Nicole Jeffries. I go to Wasilla High School. First, I would like to start out with showing you how to read these slides. At the very top, you'll see what we'll be addressing. In the middle, you'll see what defined the questions that we were asking in our survey. And at the bottom, you'll see the results divided between middle school and high school students. So here we ask meaningful participation from adults in the community. We define this by outside of the home, they're included in music or sports or a different hobby. As you can see, only 20% of middle schoolers agree. That means 1 in 5 kids are involved with the adults in their community. By the time they get to high school, it's even less. Here we ask about meaningful participation with the adults within their home. This includes going out with their parents and doing fun things with them and feeling that they make a difference in their home. In middle school, only 1 in 4 kids feel involved with the adults in their household. Think about your household and your children. Like, how involved are you with your kids? How engaged are you with your children? And then how would they respond to these questions in the survey? Here we ask about meaningful participation with the adults at school. This was defined as doing interesting activities and being involved. Unfortunately, despite common belief, only 6.4% feel engaged with the teachers and the adults at their school. So 94 kids out of 100 feel that they're able to make a difference within their school. That's somewhere that they go almost every day. So here's our first recommendation, including all the data that we derive from our survey. Data has shown us that the youth in our community have turned to substance due to boredom and having nothing to do. And providing meaningful relationships with us will provide us with the ability to be more resilient with the challenges that we face. I would now like to direct you to Robin, telling us about parental involvement.
I'm Robin Hillman. I go to Wasilla High School. This graph is going to tell you about our parents talking to their kids about substances. A lot of parents say yes in middle school, but as it gets to high school, they stop talking. And I know my parents talk to me about substance abuse like regularly, so I like stay away from it. But we just need to make sure that parents are more involved and talk to their kids about it. What age do our youth start using? So in the blue, it's 14 and under, and red is 15 to 18. So 14 and under, kids started smoking cigarettes, and 82% of them started under the age of 14. And alcohol, that's 78% under the age of 14. That's like 8 years before they're legally able to drink. And this is what surprised me the most, was 10 and under, that's fourth grade. So you have around 8% started drinking, and high schoolers that started drinking before underneath the age of 10. And that one really shocked me because I have a brother who's 13, and I'm thinking he would have, that's 3 years past. Parent perception of use. This is how the kids view, how the kids think their parents would feel. So this is, kids say that their parents feel that drinking regularly is only a little bit wrong. That's 12% feel it's only a little bit wrong. And this one, same again, green is high school, purple is middle school. But this one's about smoking cigarettes. And as Elizabeth said earlier, 50 years ago, this would have been way different, you know, wouldn't have been seen as a wrong thing. So this is, we've improved greatly, but we still have about 5% feel that it's a little bit wrong. Not, yeah. And then this is about smoking marijuana. And this one, you have around 9% of high school parents feel that it's not that wrong. And the thing we have to realize is that one parent can give hundreds of kids any kind of alcohol or drugs or anything like that. And one thing we realize too is that prevention in the middle school and high school isn't doing a whole lot. We need to hit them more in the elementary schools, because by the time they're in middle school and high school, they're already deep into drugs. So prevention in like fourth and fifth grade would probably give us lower numbers. So our second recommendation is to increase parent involvement in prevention and early intervention in the MATSU community. So just get parents involved and make sure they're aware of what their youth is doing. And I would like to introduce Jessica, who's going to talk about access to substances.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Jessica Tremaine, and I'm going to talk to you about the access. Right here, we're looking at how easy kids perceived it was to access tobacco. 54% of our youth perceive that tobacco is easy to get, 16 say that it is difficult, and 30 say that they don't know. This could potentially mean that 70% of our kids know where to get this substance. Right here we're looking at alcohol. 56% say that it's easy, 17 say that it's difficult, and 27 don't know. This brings our total to 73% of our kids could possibly know where to access this. And for marijuana, we have 47 say that it's easy, 21 say that it's difficult, and 32 don't know. 73% of our kids possibly know where to access the substance. For a third recommendation, we would like to reduce the access to these substances. In the MATSU, the youth are into a variety of these of substances, and the majority of students actually report that alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana are easy to get. And in some cases, we are above the state and national levels. And now I'd like to introduce you to Hannah.
Hello, I'm Hannah. We are going to go into a series of graphs, and on these graphs we're going to be looking at three different surveys. The first one is the Alaska Healthy Kids Survey. This is the one that we sent out to our community. The second one is Monitoring the Future. That is a nationwide given to 8th, 10th, and 12th graders, but not in Alaska. And the last one is the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which is a comprehensive nationwide, also broken down into a statewide. So I'm going to talk to you guys about tobacco. These are the effects known to an individual and community-wide. I'll let you guys go ahead and read those. So I'm going to just kind of break this down for you guys again. At the top of the slide, we're going to have the substance that we are talking about. And then below that, we're going to have the kind of time period we're discussing, and then the graphs and the numbers specific. So this time, we're talking about lifetime cigarette use. This means in your lifetime, have you ever used a cigarette? And right here, this one is a little bit unique to this slide. This is partial of a cigarette. This means what seventh graders have smoked a part of a cigarette. This is the only one that has this specific number on it. And then the dark blue that you see here, this is the Alaska Healthy Kids Survey to 7th, 9th, and 11th graders. And then next to that is the Monitoring the Future in the red. And then why are BS's purple specific to Alaska, and then the green is specific to the nation. So here you can see that we are higher than the nation as a state, and as a community we're a little bit lower, but only by a couple numbers, not a whole lot. And here we're going to talk about 30-day cigarette use. This means in the last 30 days have you smoked a cigarette? These are the kids that we're using now. These are the kids that smoked a cigarette within the last 30 days of taking this survey.
I think we got a question, Representative Seaton.
Yeah, MTF.
Monitoring the future. That's a nationwide, not asked in Alaska.
What
do
you say?
That is a survey monitoring the future?
Yes.
And can you go over again, you got the three red bars, is that 8th, 10th, and 12th? So that's 7%? Of 8th graders
in the nation used a cigarette within the last 30 days.
Okay.
That's okay. Does that all make sense?
So reading this chart then, on the Alaska survey that you put out, then in the 11th grade there's basically 20% of the students said that they'd used cigarettes within the last 30 days.
Yes, specific to the Mat-Su Valley.
Specific to the Mat-Su Valley and nationwide, or the youth in Alaska survey, I guess it'd be the best one, shows 18%, so very close similarity
exactly.
Between
That's
the surveys.
That's the point. As a state, okay. We're about 3% lower than the nation, but as a community, we are right in check with them. So this is one where we've made a little bit of striving, but not a whole lot. Which doesn't surprise me very much. This is talking about tobacco, but this time it's smokeless tobacco, chew and snuff. And this was not asked. There's no graph for the YRBS because it wasn't asked on their survey. And here we have that almost a quarter of kids have tried smokeless tobacco out of 11th graders. In the Mat-Su Valley, almost a quarter of 11th graders have tried smokeless tobacco in their lifetime. That completely blows the nationwide statistics out of the water. I personally feel like we have a very large issue with smokeless tobacco. And in the next slide here, this is in the last 30 days who has used smokeless tobacco. And as a state, we are over 3% higher than the nation. And as a community, we are about 2% higher than the nation's 12th graders. Our 11th graders are about 2% higher than the nation's 11th graders. Personally, I feel like we have a really large issue with smokeless tobacco. I feel that this comes from maybe the ability to use it, and it's a little bit less, it's easier to hide rather than blatantly smoking a cigarette. You can stick it in the corner of your mouth. No one can see it. There's lots of various ways. I was at school one day, and I honestly saw two kids walk down the hallway and take a dip out of a can and put it in their mouth, just right in the middle of the hallway. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. So, and then these numbers, we don't really focus a lot on the 7th graders, but it's ridiculous if you think about 2% of 7th graders are using smokeless tobacco. It starts young. If we wait, we are missing the train. We are completely missing them if we wait until middle school and high school to talk to them. They're already doing it. They've already tried it. All right. And that's it for me. I'd like to introduce Pat. He's going to talk to you guys about alcohol.
Before we get to Patrick, is mm-hmm. a couple of questions. Jessica, on recommendation number 3, reduce access. What are some ideas to do that?
One thing that we've kind of noticed, and we might touch up a little bit more of it, kids are getting these substances in their homes, and that's something that I've experienced with my friends doing it as well. They're accessing it from the homes, especially things like alcohol and cigarettes. I mean, their parents smoke. So their parents don't think about it. They just leave it on the counter. I mean, it's not like they count their cigarettes. I mean, they can easily take one out. They can easily take two out. Or, I mean, for expense-wise, parents are starting to roll their own cigarettes. That's an easy way for my peers to get it. Alcohol, they just leave it in a cabinet. They don't lock it up. That's something that is... Those are two things that are very easy for them to access. That are older friends. The smoking age is 19. So I'm 17. I have 19-year-old friends. I mean, it's in my age group. So it would be very simple for me to go up to one of my friends and say, hey, here's $8. Can you go pick me up a pack of Marbs?
That and with things like prescription pills. You go to the dentist, you get a prescription. Half the time you don't finish it. It sits in the cabinet. Parents don't notice when the pills go missing.
And
so awareness.
Right.
So, Hannah, you made a comment when you were talking about lifetime cigarette use and 30-day cigarette use. It didn't surprise you. Why is it just because there's, at least from the school systems that you're in the Valley, is just no big deal?
No, it's not, and that's what we're trying to change. It's not a big deal. There's only a handful of kids in our school who aren't going out and doing it. Like, there's only a handful that really feel like it's not good for you and strongly do things against it. There, I know there are plenty of kids who don't smoke and who don't want to partake in it, but they're not doing anything to actively stop it. I will not go to a party. If I have a friend that smokes, they know about it. I probably won't talk to them. I probably wouldn't be friends with them. And it's things like that. It's just so normal in our community that people do it, and that's what exactly we're trying to change.
Okay. Thank you, Hannah. Mm-hmm. Patrick,
well,
your turn. Excuse me. You have a question?
Yeah.
Representative Lynn?
Thank you, Mark. Good presentation. Is there any breakdown there between boys and girls? I would assume that, you know, I have some assumption, but is it pretty even or more boy or girl or whatever? And are girls doing more drinking and smoking than they used to, or are they both going up or down at the same time?
Well, the survey was done about 50-50 between girls and boys, but I'm not sure if there's any breakdown to those specifics.
It is on the big. I'm not sure we have it on this slide. We've got that data.
Yeah, we do have that
data. It may show up here. I'm not sure it's
on this. I don't think it's on this presentation, but this has been cut down from around like 600 slides to show you guys what we think is really important. So it's out there if you want it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Patrick, sorry for the start and stops there.
Okay, Patrick.
Please state your name for the record.
Patrick Gonzer. I'm a student at Wausau High School. All right, this just shows the negative effects of alcohol. Most of you guys probably know the majority of those. This shows the lifetime use of alcohol, and it shows that in the Mat-Su, 68% of my peers have used alcohol. That's the 11th graders. I took this survey back last year. And then it also shows 22% of 7th graders and 42% of 9th graders have used alcohol in their life. And it's a little bit lower than the rest of the nation and our state, but it's still too high for me. This is the 30-day alcohol use before taking the survey, and 38% of the 11th graders have used alcohol before taking the survey, and 9% of 7th graders. That really surprised me. Like, in 7th grade, I wouldn't have even dreamed of touching alcohol at all, ever. And I don't know, I just can't even think. My little brother, he's in 7th grade, I couldn't see him drinking ever at all. Next one is 30-day binge drinking, and 26% of 11th graders have engaged in binge drinking in the last 30 days. And this is most likely the typical party scene, just because what the definition of binge drinking is. And our definition of binge drinking is 5 or more drinks in one sitting in any particular time. Now we're going to the next substance, which is marijuana. Again, these are the negative effects of marijuana. Note that it's an asterisk next to a possible cancer link, because there's some iffy facts about it. They're not particularly sure. And this next one is the lifetime use of marijuana. And in the Mat-Su, 46% of all of the 11th graders have used marijuana. And this is a big shocker for me too, because personally, I've never touched marijuana. I've always been against that completely, 100%. And I just can't see how almost half of the 11th graders have tried it. It actually makes me sick to my stomach. The next one is in the last 30 days of before taking the survey, if they've used marijuana, and 5% of seventh graders, which is a baffling number to me again, and have used it, and 26% of the 11th graders have used it. And note, there's also almost 13% of the ninth graders have used it too.
Patrick, how many schools were surveyed? Students in schools?
Student in schools? There was 2,400 approximately students that they actually used relevant data.
Over how many schools?
There's all the Valley schools, so Houston, Wasilla, Palmer, Colony, Valley Pathways, and Burchell, as well as the homeschoolers, and then at-risk youth, and the Christian schools.
Thank you.
And now I'll introduce Jessica again. Back to this.
I'm Jessica Tremaine. So we focus mainly on tobacco, alcohol, and marijuana. But I'd like to show some graphs showing some growth in the ages. 7th grade is purple, 9th grade is blue, and 11th grade is green. Something I'd really like to point out is that 68% of our 11th graders, which would be me and my peers, are using alcohol. And that's above half. Right now we're looking at the meth, cocaine, heroin, ecstasy, and hallucinogens. And 9th grade is the blue, 11th grade, again, is the green. This scale looks much larger than it is. The graph was slightly inflated just to show the differences. 13, like our largest one here is the hallucinogens at 13%, but our alcohol is still at the 63, so it's actually drastically higher. Another thing that surprised me, even sitting in the back, just today I just realized it, and it shocked me, was that, again, I just want to go back to the 78% of kids are using under 14. So alcohol is really where we want to start our main focus, because it's the top usage and it's something that is in every home, and I personally think that it's the easier access, and it's some of the most damaging. That's where I've had a lot of my personal experience with my friends' deaths, was alcohol usage was greatly involved in that. Our recommendation number 4 is to increase our community awareness, to get our community more involved. In Alaska, we rank number 2 for illicit, meaning illegal drugs. And we rate number 6 for binge drinking. And the binge drinking is the 5 or more drinks in one sitting, which I also think that is a very average, very normal party scene. That's binge drinking will go on. If a teenager goes out to drink, I'm going to say that it's more than likely going to be binge drinking that I've seen. And now I would like to introduce you to Ms. Haynes.
Hi, thanks for hearing these kids. They're awesome to work with, and the reason I go to work in the morning. So I have a wonderful job. And I wanted to say as well, this, as I saw this slide, the TX.
Could you, please, for the record, state your name and affiliation again, please.
My name's Deb Haynes. And my affiliation is a teacher at Wasilla High School. I also have a private practice, mental health practice on my own, where I see people in therapy. And as well, I'm a wife and a mother of 3 daughters. So this data was really significant to me. I have 2 college-age kids right now and a high school kid. And the reason I talked about the therapist part is because that TX on the top. I don't know which one points. You guys will have to teach me the pointer. But the TX is about therapy. And when this slide is about what did kids say happens to them when they use drugs and alcohol. And that quarter, that biggest section, is about the kids who said that they didn't really have any problems that came from their drug and alcohol use. But the other 75 plus kids said that those things happened. The therapy, the kids that go into therapy for drug and alcohol is pretty minimal. Those are your very high-end users in high school. But it's tough for a kid to get into treatment. They have to be very, they have to have a lot of use to get them there. The other kids said any of those variety of things, and as a teacher, I have a class where I absolutely get to know my kids very well, and there's a confidentiality risk. Unless they happen to be an athlete in our school, they can tell me straight up about their drug and alcohol use, so I hear a lot, more than the average teacher, I think, because it's part of our conversation in teaching psychology and human relations, and these are the data really supported what I, as a teacher, hear in my classroom from kids, and those things that I didn't feel okay when I wasn't using. It absolutely was a numbing device for them. It kept them from going to other activities. Oftentimes I hear kids talking about quitting, but they're just not quite ready yet. And then a few of them would say that they couldn't stop. I'm going around this way. They use more than they planned, happens very frequently. And spending time with a hangover and getting drugs, using alone and thinking about stopping, and increased use. And the other thing we battle in the classroom is kids who say everybody's doing it. So despite what they think, our data is positive in the sense that it absolutely shows that not everybody is doing it. So 68% of kids have. They have to realize that there's 6 or 4 out of 10 kids who haven't drank alcohol as a junior or senior, and that's what you're seeing back here as well.
Yes, a couple of questions. First, okay. Representative Holmes, then Representative T. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of struck by something you just said. You said a lot of kids come to you, or a number of kids will come to you, and we'll talk about using, and there's a confidentiality, but with athletes, there isn't. And I was a high school athlete, and I understand there's an issue with, you know, using drugs and alcohol and not being eligible, but is that a problem that kids who are athletes, if they do run into trouble, do they have anybody they can go to?
No. I mean,
that seems
no,
like a
they don't.
Sort of a perverse incentive that there's no safe person that they can
it is.
Talk to.
It is, because if a kid talks to me or a high school counselor, there's an obligation with the rules with OSSA to report that person as somebody who's used, and they absolutely will have consequences. That's a choice they make, and that's the way our school, I believe, like every other school in the state, based on the rules that govern athletics, is true. So in order to be fair to kids, instead of setting it up for a trap, I let them know automatically, if you're an athlete in this school, you don't have the privilege of talking to me with the same confidentiality that you do with that other kids have if they're not involved in athletics. And that's how it is at our school, and I think that's a statewide.
And Mr. Chairman, so if
please
I follow, that's a state rule that's
included. Yeah, it's an OSSA rule that the consequences apply. So I don't know how. Yeah. I don't know how to tackle that one. But
thank you. That
it is troublesome. It's very difficult to tell a group of athletes or a class of kids that everybody can say everything and get some help. But if they tell, then that's going to be reported. So it is a double-edged sword.
Thank Representative you. Wilson?
That was my question. Thank you.
Oh. Any other questions? Please go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to say one more time that the reason we spent the money, and we spent a lot of money to get this data, as you can imagine, the kids had packets that were absolutely confidential put into folders. They were about 7 pages, 8 pages of survey material. And then the data was collected and made into this beautiful PowerPoint. It was a lot of time. But the reason we did that was because the Youth Risk Behavior Survey data was not available to us. Yeah, it's a big deal. Okay, so I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Desiree.
Oh, it did work. Hi, I'm Desiree. So what our community did is we set up a coalition. And the reason why, as Elizabeth was saying earlier, is that coalitions do take a lot of time, but they address the issues at a community level, mm-hmm. and they endorse culturally appropriate and cost-effective ways. Right here's just a graph that I pulled out of the interim DFC program evaluation findings report. And DFC is a federally funded SAMHSA grant for coalitions, and that's something that we're actually ready to apply for, and we've sent letters to our reps to ask for a letter of support. But you can see areas that have the DFC coalition are significantly lower in substance use rates as compared to the national average. So that's why we're going after that, because not only do they provide funding, but they provide excellent training for their coalitions. So. Okay, so a little bit about our coalition is we include leaders from our community. There are 12 sectors, as Elizabeth said earlier, and those are youth, parents, our business community, the media, schools, youth-serving organizations, law enforcement, religious and fraternal groups, civic volunteer groups, health care professionals, government officials, and tribal groups. And so we have at least one person from all of those all of those sectors on our steering committee to help us make decisions about where to go. We also focus on prevention, and by saying that, I'm not dismissing the importance of intervention or treatment, but what we're trying to do is we want to identify the risk factors and the underlying problems of use so that we can prevent this for future generations. And we do that by utilizing our data and information from community leaders. We also utilize environmental strategies, and these are aimed at changing or influencing community conditions, standards, institutions, structures, systems, and policies that will lead to long-term outcomes. What we really want to do in our community is change the social norms around drinking, where it's not no longer this is the normal thing that everybody does as they party. We really want to go after that social norm, and we want to change that. And one example of an environmental strategy is advocating law and policy changes. So I'm going to have each official a list of bills that are currently before you that we are advocating for. And as Deb mentioned and Elizabeth mentioned too, one of those is for the YRBS, I think it's 101 to change the parental consent part of it, because the reason why that wasn't available to us is because the sample size wasn't large enough. So if that law were to change, whereas parents could say we're opting out our kid out instead of having to provide consent, we would have a higher sample rate and we could use that data to really make decisions about our community. So that's one example of an environmental strategy. And I believe earlier someone asked about reducing access. So another example of an environmental strategy is increasing parental awareness and advocating for them to lock up their substances. And then another thing about our coalition is we're doing the best we can to coincide with the state plan to reduce underage drinking. And one of the items on that agenda is to develop and strengthen youth leadership in the creation of local messaging campaigns. And so our youth have really been leaders in our community, and they've been going to schools and classes and presenting this data to their peers. And by coming here to Juneau and presenting to you guys are actually supporting the state plan to reduce drinking by hearing them.
We have a question here, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, through the chair. On your SB 101 that you were talking about on the parents, because there's not enough data, doesn't it disconnect parents even more by allowing them not to have to, you know, allow their children to participate in these surveys?
I can't give you a straight answer because I haven't studied that, but I would imagine that parents maybe don't take the time to offer their consent before the survey, whereas if it's really something that they are concerned about, they still have a say, and they could still say, no, I don't want my kid to participate. But if they really don't have an opinion, we can still survey that kid, and we can still use that data to make decisions about our community.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Oh, right. Last slide. I know we're kind of behind here. So what can you guys do to support our coalition? One thing you can do is review state statutes and regulations. If you guys aren't already familiar with the state plan to reduce underage drinking, we'd like to encourage you to become familiar with that, and then also to work with members of the state committee in order to reduce access to alcohol and other substances. The law really needs to work with us in our efforts to change the social norms around drinking and drug use, and the law is a powerful message about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. You can get involved and understand your local coalition's goals and efforts. There's a place right on the SAMHSA site where you can type in the zip code if you're not a member of our community, and you can find out if there is a coalition in your community and how to reach those people. As legislators, you are key members of the community, and you have a lot of power to be able to make these policy and law changes. And that will have a ripple effect in the community and can result in long-lasting change. You can support funding for further research, especially regional breakout data. In our community, we've only begun the process of collecting data that describes the frequency, related process, risk factors, and assets. Okay, because when we first came, they said, we want to see data. And so we've begun the process of collecting the data to say, here it is. But we really need a lot more research if we're going to identify the root problems. Only after we have this empirical data that outlines the root cause of the problem can we really utilize an evidence-based intervention to address it. And then finally, support funding for prevention because it does work. It is cost-effective over waiting until it's too late and then addressing it. So on behalf of the MatSU Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition, I'd like to thank you for your time and open up the floor for any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. Any questions from committee members? Representative Keller.
Now you know why I was proud of my community. Bright kids and your demo, you know, and thanks the adults that are supporting it. They're doing what they see, and they want to raise awareness, and they're going around to the schools, and they're coming to us, and I just really commend you, and way to go. Thank you. Good, very good.
These students will be presenting at Juno Douglas High School tomorrow and Thunder Mountain to their health classes, I believe. Okay. So I understand Juno's got a mandatory drug testing for their athletes that's happening randomly. So that's very different from anywhere else in the state that I know of. So it's interesting.
Personally, the substance abuse problem, like you started out, Liz, is the cost. I mean, if you just think in economic terms, it's just mind-blowing what it's doing to us. And I would challenge all the other districts to come forward with a community plan as good as this one. So thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you, and thank you to the students especially for testifying in front of us today. Thank you very much. Okay, we'll just take a one-minute break here while we get ready for our next two bills. Okay, we're back on the record at 409. And before us, we have two more pieces of legislation, House Joint Resolution 35, which will be presented by Representative Kelly. It's my intent as chair, with co-chairs, is that we will listen to this and hold it over for possible passage at the next hearing. And then we will have Senator Coghill address us on House Bill 168 following HGR 35. With that, Representative Kelly, you have the floor, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Keller, and members of the committee. We're here today to kind of break open HGR 35, which is the Healthcare Freedom Act. There kind of as a backdrop, all of you see it on the news every night, but there's been quite a movement with the current administration toward a national single-payer system of health care. There's been a bit of a backlash to that mandated single-payer system, and we are one among 36 states, 35 other states that are in one form or another taking on, Mr. Chairman, the Healthcare Freedom Act opportunity to amend the Constitution. And HJR 35 would give the people a vote on this, and this seeks to accomplish two things. One, it would protect a person's right, a person's choice to participate or not to participate in any given health care system, and it would prohibit the government from imposing fines or penalties because that person made that decision. And secondly, it would protect the right of an individual to purchase and the right of doctors to provide lawful medical services without government interference or fines or penalties. And HJR 35 would place these rights in the Constitution of the State of Alaska. Alaskans question the need for improving health care in the areas of access and quality and affordability, and a movement toward patient-driven health care is something that is also top of mind for us. Advocates of a larger government role in providing health insurance would force individuals to join a government-approved system, and that would be the case whether they wanted to or not, whether they could afford to or not, and whether or not that system of health care would be right for them given their circumstances, their preference, and their personal needs. And I think the majority of Alaskans, I believe it's clear, oppose this mandate. They would prefer to maintain personal choice in health care, and they are very concerned that they not be forced to do otherwise. If this is adopted, will it cause a problem in our relationship with the federal government? Could it result in a lawsuit? Yes, it could, particularly if a significant block of states, and 36 of them, that's a significant number, move in the direction to protect their citizens in regard to their personal choice of doctor, health care, and insurance, then it is possible that we will get into a row with the federal government. It is also possible, maybe even probable, that this particular Supreme Court at this time may well look at this protection of the personal choice, this private choice of what I'm going to do regarding the health care for this one body that I have. It's possible that they may lean toward supporting states' rights in this area. I'll point out that nowhere in the federal constitution is the right to regulate health care covered. Now, as we all know, that under the Supremacy Clause and the Interstate Commerce Clause, the two most often mentioned as a way for reach around by the Fed in this area, they're real, and they're a real threat, and it's never 100% sure that we could win this. But we believe that in this particular case, with the very personal nature of health care, that we may well prevail. So have we thought about that possibility of a legal entanglement with the Fed? Yes, we have. And does that scare us off the bill? No, it doesn't. And 35 other states feel the same way. First ones out of the chute involved Arizona, and they were quickly followed by Alaska and a group of others, and that number just keeps growing. So, Mr. Chairman, we stand ready to answer any questions that the committee has, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the intent. I'm looking at the way the bill works here, and I'm just trying to get up to speed. Sorry, I've been involved in other things. But on page 2, starting on line 2, where it says, no law shall be passed that compels a person, employer, or health care provider to participate in a health care system, does that mean that the state of Alaska could not initiate a new tier in a retirement system? Or in the active system that provides health care through the state or a school district, if school districts have TERS or PERS, is that, have you looked at that, Representative Kelly, as far as the public retirement system and the state as an employer or the school districts or municipalities as employers?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, since you mentioned a change or a future event, it's apparent that you understand that the current bill doesn't look back but looks ahead. So I won't go into that element of it. And while I'm not pretending to be able to do the legal interpretation here, as we look forward, it does not take away a person's right to seek employment, nor of the employer to make requirements relative to that employment. But as far as the specific question you asked, what we can do between now and the next meeting is take that, Mr. Chairman, since you intend to hold the bill, we'd be happy to get an answer for you on that. I think I know what it is, and I'd like to say that no, it doesn't affect that, but I would prefer, Mr. Chairman, to get you the legal answer.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's why I was phrasing the question, so it could come back in, you know, in writing for our next meeting. Thank you.
Through the chair, I'd be happy to do that.
Look forward to that. Questions? Yes, Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kelly, I'm looking through this, and I flipped through the supporting documents, and the supporting documents do sort of address my question. My question has to do with Medicare, TRICARE, Indian Health Services, those types of plans. And I know that the bill says no law shall be passed, which I take it means it's looking at future legislation, not things that are already on the books. But Medicare, for instance, has limits in it, and I believe TRICARE and IHS and a lot of these other programs have things that would, if they were to be passed today, blatantly violate the language of this, because, for instance, you can't do a copay. You can't come in as a Medicare patient and pay an additional amount on top. I'm kind of worried about going forward if there are any changes made. We all know Medicare in this state in particular is having some problems, and we're actually, a lot of us are actively advocating that Medicare laws be changed to make it more accessible to Alaskans. I'm kind of afraid that the language in this bill would tie Congress's hands going forward on some of those programs that we may actually really want them to, you know, when it comes to veterans and other TRICARE things, we may really want them to make some good changes. And some of the language, especially on sort of the bottom of page one, that prohibits a person from or penalizes a person from making direct payments to a health care provider for tendering health care services. I'm kind of worried about that language in that context. I was hoping you could either now or in the future address some of those concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is our belief that it does not have a negative effect on those programs that are in place, such as the Veterans Administration, Workers Compensation, Medicaid, those programs that you mentioned. But it does retain and reinforce the personal choice. I mean, you can choose or choose not to be in Medicare. If you walk away from it, Mr. Chairman, you end up walking away from a system that has all sorts of requirements. And if you choose to be in it, which you're free to do under this bill as well, you have to take the conditions which are in that program. This just allows you the freedom to get on or off the train. And if you go away from it, to be able to purchase your own insurance, to choose your own care. So if you're in, you're in, and you have to follow the rules. But if you're out, and they can refuse to pay and do all kinds of things that they have in their rule system, and it doesn't change that. It doesn't attempt to change that. It just says if you want to walk away from that, or in any instance you want to go get care on your own, you can do that. You're free to do that. And if they say, well, we're not paying for that one, you didn't go to hospital X, you went to hospital Y, doesn't change that. If you're in that program, they can still do that. That is our understanding of how the bill would work. If we can help you further on that, we'd be happy to do so.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Kelly, of course, the Speaker gave it three referrals: Health and Social Services, Judiciary, and Finance. Finance is a small fiscal note for the publication. Could you just share with the committee where this committee should focus its policy debate, and then just quickly where you think Judiciary would weigh in on this?
Good question, Mr. Chairman. I think that I guess dividing up the pie appropriately, naturally the Finance Committee would address as you pointed out the cost, and I think the Judiciary Committee is going to want to look at the constitutionality of this. They're going to want to look at the the risk of a federal-state clash and perhaps the likelihood that one might prevail and ways to word this bill in a way that would hopefully ensure that if it moves ahead that we would prevail. And I think this committee kind of looks at things like this just from watching how the committee functions, would be looking to see if this is in the best overall health care interests of the state. And is this what the citizens would they prefer to have this right, this choice, or in the contrary, would they no? This is not what they'd like. They are desirous of the system that is being proposed at the national level. But I think that's where I see this committee focusing is on that. Is this something that the people of Alaska would like as a policy matter, whereas the judiciary and the finance are more limited in their overview, or tend to be more limited?
Okay. It is an intent of the chair to bring this back up in 7 days, next Tuesday, and as a co-chair, I have no objection to moving it on to judiciary, but we'll give time for questions that have been brought up, and then that how you've articulated it is this committee should debate the health and social services part of this proposed resolution. And two more questions, Representative Sisson, then Representative Seaton.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate being able to add these questions for the future. As Representative Kelly, I know that you are aware of just how many problems that Alaska has in health, and that we've got over 100,000 people who do not have any kind of health coverage at all. And that's a problem that just hangs on no matter what. And certainly in my term here in the legislature, I've heard from probably hundreds, actually, of families that have really, really suffered from there not having been a real effort to come up with some solutions. We're a new state, and we don't have the kind of infrastructure that other states have. We have real capacity problems throughout the state with the health structures that we've got. And we are a state that is addicted to addictions. We unfortunately succumb to the advertising for things that destroy the health of our people. We're in real tough shape, and I'm trying to understand how this piece of legislation actually addresses the problems that this committee has looked at and not fully answered, because we continue to hold our position with all these addictions that are all preventable, and continue to have Alaskans very in a real big problem with access in a number of ways, and not having the fixes here that address that. And I don't see probably if I were going to map it out exactly. The market system works where there's great information. So the people, when they spend their dollar, spend it knowing what they're going to get. And in this state, we have real serious problems with that. And we can't do the preventative part because, unfortunately, the other messages win out on addictive stuff. We're not finding the doctors. We're not finding all of that stuff. So I'd love to hear suggestions of why this fits anything that would really fix our problems. Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, just a couple of comments on that. I've served on a hospital foundation for about 20 years now. So I, in addition to being a patient, I'm somebody who's been involved in policy making and pretty close to a hospital system for actually over 20 years now. And there's no doubt that the current healthcare system needs improvement. But I'm one of those who maintains that it is still among the very finest healthcare systems on the earth, on an imperfect earth, on an earth that's always striving and never quite hitting the target. But I am convinced of one thing, that if we look at the access question and just take, how does government do on that? Well, they pay doctors at 30 to 50 cents on the dollar, and then they wring their hands about, I wonder why we can't get doctors to work. Well, I won't drive a truck for 30 to 50 cents on the dollar, fly an airplane for that. Nobody wants to work for peanuts when they went to school to be a doctor. So what we have is a system that disincents doctors, and it is the government element of that that has us in the trouble as far as attracting and retaining doctors. The more we separate the patient from the provider and the cost of that, I think the worse it gets. So as we look at a direction that might cause better health care, and our emergency rooms are plugged with the frequent flyers that in our town, about 100 of them, and yet that very system that we criticize also makes sure that anyone who needs emergency care gets that care. So I'm at once convinced that we have the best health care system, or certainly among the best health care systems on the earth, and that we need to make some changes in that, but that those changes, being government centralized control, I believe may well be at the heart of the problem with our health care system, not among the choices for the best solution. So I guess it's a matter of where we think we go from here to solve, and as the representative from Anchorage knows, Mr. Chairman, she's head of the health caucus, we do have those very real problems, and I very much respect that. It's just I see the centralization, the government takeover of the system, and I look at that and say, how are they doing so far? And I say, lousy. Medicaid's burying us. Medicare patients can't be seen. And I don't want more of that. I want less of that. So it's a directional thing, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, what we have in the queue here is Representative Seaton, Representative Wilson, and co-chair Representative Wes Keller. So Representative Seaton, please.
Thank you, and I did have a couple. And the first one was, I just wanted to get some clarification as what you see. If this prevents us from, I wanted to get a clarification. First of all, there's nothing that we're going to pass here that prevents the federal law from passing, but what this constitutional amendment would prevent the legislature from the state from passing a law. And we've got existing programs. Now, if there are major changes to those and we want to, like FMAP percentages or something else that we needed to pass a statute to accept, whether it's greater FMAP percentages or whatever, would that qualify as this prohibition on this law, or is this only a newly named program? And I'm just putting forward the questions, and you can get back to me with the answers I'd appreciate it having them writing so we can get them clarified. And then I guess the other question is, this as a constitutional amendment, this is going forward, and it's not going to do anything to prevent the federal government from doing anything. This is simply to stop future legislatures from being able to adopt the program that the federal government puts forward. I want to know if that's what I'm seeing. I think that's what this bill is, or this resolution is intended to do. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I think this, let's go from the weakest effect that this bill might have, the very least effect it might have. And I think that is that it would send a signal that we are one among 35 states that are against additional federal controls relative to our choice as to doctor, insurance company, paying for our own health care, and that sort of thing. I think that's the least it does. And some might say, well, that's about all we think it's going to do, because at the federal level, we're not setting the laws, except as we elect representatives and send signals to them about what they might think about as they go back to Washington and vote. So I think that's on the one side. On the other side, then, if in fact something comes along after this, if this were to pass and become embedded in the Constitution, someone comes along to Citizen X, let's just say his name is Kelly, and says, you're going to get in our new program, and you've got no choice. And I look at this, the law of the land in Alaska, and I say, not going to do it. And I rely on the fact that in Alaska, we say no one can be forced to do this. That's over at the other pole, on the most strict application that this law may effect. And Mr. Chairman, if all we could get is this, I would still keep the blade down and the black smoke rolling on getting this bill through. And if we could get this, I would be very happy. So in that broad spectrum, Mr. Chairman, what the will of the body is, I'm willing to live with.
Your follow-up?
And just a follow-up, I guess what I'm saying is this is a constitutional amendment to restrict the ability of the legislature from passing a law, even if that legislature in the future deems that it's in the public interest to pass a law. I mean, we've got 19.8% increase in our active health care this year, and estimated 20% increase in the insurance cost, our self-insurance cost for next year. And if something comes along in a couple years and it would be a better deal, as the legislature determines, for the people of the state of Alaska, this is a constitutional amendment would prevent us from adopting or rolling into that plan, if it has the employers or any portion of that bill would penalize a person such as Part D for not signing up at a certain time. This would prevent future legislature from adopting or rolling into that plan without going through a constitutional amendment repeal. Am I correct in that?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
I think he actually confused me more through the chair. Have you heard anything negative about this so far? Any concerns from the public?
Through the chair. Mr. Chairman, I would say that the concern about a headbutt with the federal government would be one area of concern. And the second area of concern, as has come up in this committee, would be, gosh, could this be complicating relative to existing programs that are in effect that, whether we like it or not, are on the ground and operating? And I'll stop there. I think those are the two areas. And Derek, any others that you can? Yeah, through the chair.
Follow-up, sir?
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Do you think those two things outweigh right now the fear that people have with being forced into a program that they don't want and us sitting back at the state acting like we don't care?
Through the chair, Mr. Chairman, I believe that the overwhelming communications that we receive say, don't force me to do it. We like this bill.
Thank you.
And our final question, comment, Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As prime co-sponsor of this bill, I just want to say, Representative Kelly, you did a very fine job of presenting it. I'm enthused with the bill. I just wanted to point out a few things with the indulgence of the chair. It's not a question. One is this bill has been vetted very clearly in Arizona. It's been through two cycles of legislative process. So, plus, it's been endorsed in your packet and by the largest legislative group organization in the U.S. And I just wanted to point out that there are many legislators in these other states that this is pending, and there are attorneys, et cetera, listening carefully. And there's the beauty of being in that position, Representative Kelly, is it's hard to come up with a question that you can't answer. And I think that your question, Representative Seaton, was you kind of answered it. It was precisely what the bill does. It forbids any law that we have would be unconstitutional that would forbid an individual in the state of Alaska from securing medical care outside of the required medical system is there. And I would like to say that that's exactly what the Constitution does. That is the law of the land. That is the people's law. And that's why this is a resolution that goes before the people to make that decision to say, yes, we want to retain that freedom, and we do not want it to be a football. But again, thank you for indulging me in that. When you've been engaged in a bill, it's hard to you squirm and you want to. But I do want to say again that Representative Kelly did a really good job. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We do have a couple of people to testify. I will hold this public testimony open till next Tuesday, when we will debate it and consider moving it to judiciary. So, at this time, Christy Herrera, are you online?
We already have been in the Constitution.
Mike Prax, do you wish to testify this? You signed up, but no indication whether you testify or not.
I would like to add my thoughts.
Please state your name and affiliation for record, please.
Hey, my name is Mike Prax, 1015 Metaroo, North Pole, and just speaking on my own behalf.
Please go ahead.
And I'm kind of sad, I guess, that so many members of our society have lost their moral compass to the point that they're condoning taking away an individual's choice even over what they want to do with their body to achieve a social objective. And that's what the national health care proponents are trying to accomplish. That's really sad. And so I support this bill specifically because I think it might set up a confrontation between the state and the federal government over this particular issue. And I think that the current federal administration has assumed that it has absolute authority and absolute power, and it's completely out of control. So I think a clash is inevitable, and the question is only whether that confrontation is going to be between the federal government and the state government in court, which is where it belongs, or whether it's going to be the federal government and the people on the street, which we hope to prefer. So I hope you guys don't get too wound up in the details of should the state government be as despotic as the federal government and just pass this legislation and protect our individual rights to make decisions. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Prax. One other is signed up, Peggy Ann. Are you available?
I'm here.
Yes, please come forward. Sorry, I didn't want to mispronounce your last name, but please state your name and affiliation for the record.
You bet. My name is Peggy Ann McConaughey. I'm from Juneau, Alaska. I have a small business, and I also am here representing NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to be able to speak to you. I am a small business owner. I have a real estate brokerage firm, and also my husband has a small tour company, and hopefully as of March 1st, if everything goes okay, we're going to expand into a retail company, which is great, but because my husband's from New Zealand and has had, unfortunately, family experience with the single-payer system they have over there, which I will tell you is very similar to what they have in Canada, which is something the president talks a lot about, is a system that does not fit. It does not fit for us personally. It does not fit for Alaskans, and that's what I want to talk to you about today. It does not provide lower cost, greater availability, or choice in any matter. I'm also one of those who has a pre-existing condition, and yet I am totally against what our federal government is trying to do, and very much appreciative of your bid to help protect Alaskans from what the federal government would put upon us as individual Alaskans and who would also put upon us as small business owners. We're very concerned that no matter what is said right now, that they're going to relook at the bills, something's going to come down that's going to negatively affect small businesses. And what I mean negatively affect, I mean increase our bottom line. Small business is something that's very precious, especially for all of us who've been in it all of our lives. But it is something that can easily go under with additional fees put on by the federal government, and that's what we see coming down the road. Not protecting people and providing them greater choice, but in essence, in this case, taking it over from a governmental end and telling us what to do and telling us what we'll pay. If either the bill in the House or the Senate in the federal government was allowed to pass, it would probably end our retail side of our business. We're just getting ready to open. So to not speak long, we encourage you to help protect small businesses from being unreasonably taxed, for not providing health care for our employees, our Alaskans. We like what you've done with HJR 35. We support it completely for as far as NFIB and us small businesses, because small businesses have enough problems to deal with without additional mandates and taxes. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Peggy Ann? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Apparently, Christy was muted. Let's go back to Christy Herrera. Do you wish to testify? And this public testimony will be held over till next Tuesday as well. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. My name is Christy Herrera, and I'm director of the Health and Human Services Task Force at ALEC. For those of you who don't know about ALEC, we are a nonpartisan nationwide association of lawmakers with 1,800 members across the country. Testifying today to commend HJR 35, which is modeled after ALEC's own Freedom of Choice in Healthcare Act, now in 36 states. We applaud this bill for three key reasons. One, we believe this bill will ensure continued access to health services. Citizens should have the right to pay directly for health services. We know that when the government controls the dollars, they make treatment decisions based on what is best for the government, and this usually leads to rationing or waiting lists. We believe that patients, not bureaucrats, should decide what is best for patients. Second, we believe this bill will stop mandates that just don't work. In Massachusetts, a state that has had both an individual and employer mandate since 2006, more than a third of their uninsured still don't have coverage. Health insurance costs 40% more than in the rest of the country. It's harder for the newly insured to see a doctor, and legislators there expect a $2 to $4 billion shortfall over the next decade. Simply put, we know that it's important for people to have health insurance coverage, but a government requirement to purchase it is ineffective, bureaucratic, and costly. Finally, we believe this bill may help shield Alaska from a federal mandate. Of course, we know this bill would render unconstitutional any state attempt to either impose an individual or employer mandate or any state attempt to prohibit direct payment for medical care. The bill may also cause a federalism clash if Congress passes a law with either of these provisions. And in this case, the courts must balance those competing interests, and we found that recent Supreme Court cases have upheld the power of states to protect these freedoms. Now, there are a few misconceptions about this bill. Some would say it would block all federal health reform, which is not true. This bill would not attempt to block any federal law as long as it doesn't require an individual or employer mandate or forbid patients from paying directly for medical care. Citizens can still participate in the proposed public option, the National Health Insurance Exchange, and the Medicaid expansion. They just can't be forced into those choices. Another misconception is that this bill will exacerbate the free rider problem. But the problem is that free riders will continue to show up in the emergency room with or without a mandate. The Massachusetts data reveal that their mandate actually increased ER usage by 17%. And even if a mandate did solve the free rider problem, we would still be paying for the newly insured with subsidies to purchase the required insurance. Under federal proposals, a low-income family of four would qualify for more than $20,000 in government subsidies. So in conclusion, with health reform talks accelerating at the state and federal levels, ALEC applauds HJR 35 because we believe it ensures that the cornerstone of any reform is the protection of patients' rights. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Christy, for your testimony. And Representative Seaton, you have a question or a comment?
I had a question, Chairman.
Briefly, please.
Yes, and that was just on the question that I'd asked earlier. It sounds like you're really familiar with the bill here, where it says that no law shall be passed that compels an employer to provide or provider to participate in the health care system. Do you have you looked at any other has the issue arisen in any other jurisdiction about a change of a new tier in a state retirement system, and whether that would restrict the state's ability to institute a new tier in a retirement system for the state itself, because where it's saying no law can be passed?
I think that Representative Kelly was correct in saying this is a forward-looking bill rather than one that affects current programs. The intent of this bill is not to affect any of the safety net programs or any rule changes that they might enact as part of their operation. As you pointed out, it would preclude the state from enacting either an individual or an employer mandate to purchase health coverage.
All right. Thank you, Christy. At this time, we'll keep public testimony for next Tuesday, when we will consider moving the bill from to the next committee referral. So at this time, we will move on to the next item, House Bill 168.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Kelly. Could we have the Honorable John Coghill, Senator from District F, come forward, please? Now, this bill was heard in last session, and so this is a follow-up, and we will try to get as much done as we can today, sir, but please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much for hearing the bill. Simply put, in broad terms, this is creating an account or a piggy bank that we can put money in, and we want hospitals to dip into it after they've proven some movement towards increasing or improving their trauma system delivery. And the way we've done that is we've allowed the commissioner, the department, to come up with regulations that take national standards for trauma care, the 1, 2, 3, or 4 designation, and evaluate what they're doing and how they're doing it in moving towards better trauma care. So, Mr. Chairman, we did actually hear this bill late last year, and so the trauma issue itself, I think most people are fairly familiar with, and I put a packet together so that you would have, you know, all of the information that we had last year together. But I will tell you this, Mr. Chairman and committee members, that during the interim, my purpose was to keep pushing this issue forward, because this is simply one incentive among many things that the College of Surgeons asked the state of Alaska to look at. And I can report to you, Mr. Chairman, that during the course of the summer, there were several things that happened that I think were positive in the trauma response system in Alaska. One of them was that the department actually did take a position that they had and turned it into a person who, when they wake up in the morning, they are thinking about trauma response systems in Alaska and how to work with the native healthcare system and the other healthcare system that deals with all the rest of Alaskans. So I think that's a positive move. I have met with the Emergency Medical Council that we have in statutes, and have talked with them and have been encouraged by their focus on response systems in Alaska, including all the way up into the remote areas where the only way to do it is by healthcare facilities in remote areas that are really health aides. And have to call airplanes as their ambulance, to the road system that I now represent, Mr. Chairman, that has a lot of miles between a time somebody might either get into a car wreck or get shot or have some other trauma circumstance. We have a lot of EMT and EMS people all over Alaska that are heroes. They're just heroes. So what we're trying, what I want to do, and what I think we need to do in dovetailing with what the College of Surgeons have put before us, is how to better have a better coordinated effort at emergency response system. And so I think we've made forward motion on that throughout the summer. That doesn't answer the problem entirely. So what I thought to do is to take this bill and put together a fund and say, within that fund, what can we do to incentivize hospitals to ratchet up their level of trauma care system? And I think hospitals are interested in doing it, but the model in Alaska is a tough model to get to, and I'll tell you why. We want docs up here. We want the doctors to be able to open up their private offices, put their shingle out, and offer health care to people on a fee-for-service basis. And these docs, men and women, get to work in the emergency response system by being the docs that are on call in the hospitals. And we need to incentivize a good and well-planned working relationship between the hospital and these doctors. And that's tough going. So probably the uncompensated care would be the first place to start. That is not the only place. I can tell you this is the smallest place to start. But this gives us an opportunity to put money in and say, if we will help you coordinate your efforts and we will help equip our EMS people, but we want you to take some of the uncompensated care and begin the process of ratcheting up your response by having docs work in your ERs in a better way, or ratcheting up your trauma level care. Now, in your packet under tab 3, if you'll look under tab 3 on, I think it's on page 9, page 6, you'll see in Alaska we have 24 hospitals in Alaska. And of those 24 hospitals, we have one level 2, and that's the Native Hospital in downtown Anchorage. All the rest are level 4, none of them in Anchorage. And so you have 9 other facilities with reviews. And that is not to make them look bad, because I can tell you the hospitals in Anchorage do a yeoman's job. But I sure would like to see us get that designation that ratchets up the confidence in Alaska and creates that systemic approach to emergency response systems with the docs in the hospitals. And incentivizing it is the best way I could think of to start. So that's what House Bill 168 does. And there's a Senate companion doing the same thing. If you'll look on page 9 of that very same tab, you'll see that this falls into one of the recommendations. But you'll also see under the recommendations on the right-hand side of page 9 that I have, with my staff's help and with the emergency medical trauma system people, have actually been able to get together and make some moves forward, including, Mr. Chairman, working with the military folks in Alaska who have trauma docs that are used to working in combat trauma circumstances, to where we even approached the medical board on how do we create licensing structures so that they could work with our hospitals. I'm here to say that's not a done deal, but it's on the right track and we're moving forward. Some of it is going to be how do we hand off patients from a Air Force or an Army doctor to a doctor who has a local license. But I can tell you, it's not an impossible problem, and I'll tell you why. Because right now we have locums doctors, or doctors for hire or rent, coming up from the lower 48 working in our hospitals who still have to hand off to local doctors. So it can be done. So I think the two issues that I'm concerned about is equipping and training those who work in the outer reaches of Alaska on the road systems and in the rural areas. I think we can do that through some capital budget issues, and I will be a champion to do some of that. And then this, to create a fund that says to the hospitals, can we do better? And will money help us in the uncompensated care so we can move from that step up to another step? And I'm hoping to see in Anchorage another level 2 trauma center, but at the very least a trauma level 3. And so that's the whole purpose of this bill, is to create the piggy bank, give them a reason to reach into the piggy bank.
Okay, we have several people that have signed up, and they've taken the time to sign up, so I think we'll take the public testimony. The first one is actually Representative Cisna, and she asked that this be read into the record. I have an unavoidable conflict and won't be able to remain in this meeting. Broadening the discussion with all stakeholders would be an improvement. Increasing other incentives also would be beneficial. I am in favor of passage of this bill as well as strengthening the bill. Representative Sharon Cisna. So we have five people signed up, three online and two in the room. Let's go to the first one. David Hall, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name's David Hall, and I'm the chair of the Governor's Alaska Council on Emergency Medical Services, or ACAMS, and I am a fire chief of the North Tongass Volunteer Fire Department here in Ketchikan.
Please go ahead with your testimony.
Okay, first of all, I've got the permission of my council to speak on their behalf, but there's no way I'm going to do any better than that first group we all heard. Those kids were something else. I just want you all to know that I've been a firefighter and a paramedic with over 35 years of responding to all kinds of emergency calls for help, and those numbers seem to increase every year, especially trauma calls. I've seen injuries that I can still see when I close my eyes and exposed to smells that stick with you for a lifetime. Trauma is any bodily injury from an external source. Trauma can be accidental or it can be intentional. Trauma puts a tremendous burden on families and communities in Alaska. An average of 400 Alaskans die each year from trauma. For every death, 11 people are hospitalized. In 2004, a study showed that the economic cost of the hospital stay alone for trauma patients in Alaska was estimated at over $73 million. One in four hospital admissions was uncompensated for, which puts an additional burden on the state's hospitals and healthcare system. A trauma system is a predetermined, organized, multidisciplinary response to managing the care and treatment of severely injured people. A statewide trauma system also provides a framework for disaster preparedness and response. For a severely injured person, the time between an injury and receiving definitive care is the most important predictor of survival. Senator Coghill spoke of that. It's called the golden hour. The local EMS responders from across the state have gotten pretty darn good at getting viable trauma victims to the hospitals. It then becomes the hospital's and the doctor's responsibility to keep up our good work. Increased hospital participation is necessary for a statewide trauma system to function optimally. The goal of a statewide trauma system is to see that every hospital in Alaska becomes designated as a trauma center at an appropriate level. The ultimate goal, however, of everyone involved is to save lives. The Alaska Council on Emergency Medical Services seeks your support for a fully functioning trauma system, including funding for the development of trauma centers and legislation addressing the issue of incentives for trauma care designation and uncompensated care of trauma patients. I would like to thank Senator Coghill for all his work on this bill, as well as many others. Please consider this request. Join our quest for a coordinated approach to trauma management. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Let's move on to the next person signed up on the system. To the following people that testifies, please keep your comments succinct. Dr. Frank Sacco, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah, my name is Frank Sacco. I'm a general surgeon and the trauma director at the Alaska Native Medical Center. I also serve as the chair of the Alaska State Trauma Systems Review Committee, which looks at trauma care throughout the state. Again, I think Dave Hall certainly summed things up succinctly. I can say that, you know, most of the time when we talk about systems, the first things people, their eyes start to close. But the reason we talk about trauma systems is that they make a difference. Trauma injury is the leading cause of death for Alaskans, you know, under 44 years of age. And so it's a major health problem. It's a major cost. And it's hard to meet a family up here whose lives haven't been touched or changed forever by injury in the family. You know, the reason we are pursuing this is that, you know, we're not on the leading edge of trauma care here. We're on the leading edge of trauma. We have the second highest rate of trauma in the country. But, you know, all over the country, if you can put in an inclusive trauma system where everybody participates in getting the right patient to the right place at the right time, then we can decrease mortality 15% to 25%. And we see those kind of differences when we look at designated facilities versus non-designated facilities up here. You know, we tried the Alaska statute, written in the early 90s, was a good statute, except that it was completely voluntary. There was no incentive or disincentive for the hospitals to participate, and as a result, we've gone over 15 years now, and we still, as John Coghill brought up, we just have one level two trauma center. I think where we are is, you know, summed up, the College of Surgeons basically in their review said the achievements to date have been largely unplanned with limited coordination. As a result, incongruity exists with the current trauma system. Several native facilities have sought and achieved verification and designation. The facilities are to be commended for their dedication and commitment. However, to date, few of the facilities serving the majority of the population have made a similar commitment to achieving nationally recognized standards of trauma care. And I think to carry it out, you know, Alaska now is the only state out of 50 that doesn't have a level two trauma center that takes care of the majority of the population. The Native Hospital certainly takes care of non-Native patients in emergencies and on a regular basis, but the majority of Alaskans get their care at non-verified, non-designated trauma centers. And Anchorage is the biggest city in the United States without a designated level one or two trauma center for the majority of the population. I think that this bill, which is an incentive for the hospitals to participate, is a good step, and I think that it'll move us forward. And if it doesn't work, then we just need to keep going forward. This is not a partisan issue. This is, you know, red states, blue states have trauma systems. This affects everybody. And I think I appreciate John Coghill and Betty Davis for their leadership on this, and be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Let's move on. We have three more to go. Dr. Chenault, please state your name, affiliation, and begin your testimony, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you. My name is Regina Chenault. I'm a general surgeon. I live in Anchorage. I'm actually the state chair for the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma. I'm also the physician member on the Violent Crimes Compensation Board, and I also serve on the Alaska's Trauma Systems Review Committee. And I think it is a shame that Alaska is the only state without a designated trauma hospital for the general public. I am a wife and a mother of three children. I'm very concerned about this. I do work at the Native Hospital, which is the only level two hospital, and our mission is to provide care to Alaska Natives. I've had the pleasure of providing surgical care in Alaska in several different locations, Soldotna, Kodiak, Ketchikan, Anchorage, private practice, and stated at the Native Hospital. We have a lot of trauma in the state, a lot of domestic violence with women and children being shot, stabbed, raped, beaten to death. And I think that we just have to have this trauma designation pass to ensure that we Alaskans get the same standard of care for trauma that people in the other 49 states are already receiving. This trauma designation is like flight safety for pilots and airlines. We want an organized systems approach to trauma care that makes us all have a 25% higher chance of living after having an injury. I think we have to implement this as soon as possible. I think it becomes a matter of ethics and bad behavior if we allow Alaskans to continue on not receiving the national standard of trauma care. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. We have two more to go. Mark Johnson. Mark, please state your name and affiliation and begin your testimony for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Mark Johnson. I am a current member of the Alaska Trauma System Review Committee. I served for many years as Chief of Emergency Medical Services for the state of Alaska. I live in Juneau. I support the legislation. As other speakers have mentioned, this is a life or death issue. We will improve care if we can get more of the hospitals to meet the national standards. I have with me a copy of the resources for optimal care of the injured patient put out by the American College of Surgeons, which sets the national standards, best practices for trauma centers at the various levels. As has been mentioned, the American College of Surgeons also did a review of our statewide system in November 2008 in Anchorage and developed a report that was put out in January of 2009 that lists about 70 recommendations, of which 16 were listed as priority. And they recommend that every facility in the hospital in the state should be designated at an appropriate level, which includes level 4 for the small rural hospitals, level 3 mid-sized communities, and then level 2 for Anchorage. I've dealt with this issue in this state for about 3 decades. I can give you a long history of some of the problems and issues that we've encountered over those years. I believe that we can do it. This is simply an incentive. There are a number of ways to do it. Disincentives or incentives, disincentives for not doing it or incentives for doing it. I think this is a step in the right direction to provide an incentive for doing it, and I do think it will help make progress in this area. So, again, I could also answer questions if you like.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to our final person that signed up to testify, then we'll ask the sponsor a couple of quick questions before we close. Ward Hurlbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity. Thank you to come and talk with you. I'm the Chief Medical Officer for the Department of Health and Social Services and the Director of the Public Health Division. Fairly new in the job, and one of the things I learned early on was that our folks really appreciated the leadership and support that Senator Coghill has provided in this whole area in our state. My personal background started out in Alaska as a general physician out in Dillingham and worked there and had that perspective. And then I am a general surgeon and worked at the Alaska Native Medical Center and practiced there over about a 25-year period. Dr. Sacco was one of my colleagues there. And so I've had a lot of personal experience with trauma. It's been pointed out that trauma is the number 3 cause of death in our state, second only to cancer and heart disease. But when you look at folks that are age 1 to 44, it's the number 1 cause. And that's our future, and this is a serious issue for our state. Speaking on behalf of the administration, we certainly recognize, and Senator Coghill said, the quality of care and appreciate the quality of care that's provided at the various hospitals around our state. But we've learned from the Trauma Systems Review Committee some things about the certification on classification of the hospitals that's been provided. We learned the things that have been mentioned. The American College of Surgeons review of our trauma systems in our state that was done in the fall of 2008 noted that our trauma infrastructure is unplanned, underdeveloped, under-resourced, and lacks sufficient coordination and integration. We are concerned about the things that Dr. Sacco mentioned about Anchorage being the largest city in the country without a level 1 or 2 trauma center. Probably doesn't make sense to have a level 1. Harborview serves that purpose for our citizens. We've also learned that the New England Journal of Medicine reported, as Dr. Sacco reported, about a 25% improvement in mortality experience when trauma victims go to certified hospitals. We recognize that participation has been voluntary, but we also understand that the criteria that the American College of Surgeons developed are used across the country. And that's what we as Americans have adopted as the way to improve our systems. We also recognize that it's not just hospitals, that it's hospitals and physicians that need to be supportive. And the administration does encourage the healthcare systems to collaborate. I'll just mention briefly, Pierce County in Washington State, where Tacoma is, there are two hospital systems there, the Franciscans that operate St. Joseph's, MultiCare that operates Tacoma General, and several other hospitals there. But two competing systems that have collaborated on providing the trauma resource for that city. In addition, Madigan, the military hospital there, has participated. They don't have an Alaska Native healthcare hospital, but you can see the analogies for Anchorage, and that has worked out. We do encourage healthcare systems and the physician community to develop a more mature trauma system because of concerns about mandating this, because of concerns about the dollar amount, and what has happened in various states varies about whether there is government money put in or whether there are other ways of obtaining it. And we appreciate looking for ways to incentivize this, but for those reasons, the position of the administration is neutral, but that doesn't mean that we don't recognize all the things that I've just recited as real challenges for our state. I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, the opportunity.
Thank you, Doctor.
To comment.
We're being asked to get out of the room, but before we do that, I guess I'll go back to the sponsor. Is I've passed out an amendment, you know, figuring starting the debate about how we can fund this. So briefly, we're going to get kicked out by Economic Development, Trade, and Tourism, but your opinion on the proposed amendment, and then I'll make some housekeeping comments, and then we'll close.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, Mr. Chairman, this is a good amendment. It's one among many good things that we probably could do, but the reality is this would be drawn from the general fund but it does point, and an arrow pointing is going to be helpful. So it is an appropriation matter that we're all going to have to deal with if I want to have any money in this piggy bank. So this is a good arrow. Thank you.
Okay. The intent, I'll work with my co-chair, the intent is to bring this back in the very near future. So at that time, be prepared to debate amendments, and it will be the intent to move this along if the committee deems that suitable at that time. So thank you, Senator.
Thank
from
you, Mr.
District
Chairman.
4. And we miss you over in the other body.
Right here. You were right.
Oh, we'd be
like
an airport.
We like you, though.
5:14, we are.